Lecture 25, The Issues and Events of 1857.
Throughout the torrid summer of 1857, across the heart of the North Indian Gangetic Plain, Indians and Britons clashed viciously. Fighting and heartless executions continued for more than a year, leaving tens of thousands of men, women, and children dead. In many ways, these bloody events marked a major turning point in the history of India, affecting virtually everyone, either directly or indirectly. It radically reshaped relations between Indians and Britons, and also the nature of colonial rule over India. The historical meanings of these events of 1857 have remained heatedly contested ever since. Most Britons at that time, and many down until today, have thought of this as the Sepoy Mutiny. This highlights disloyal Indian soldiers who rose up against their British officers and killed hundreds of them and their families. In contrast, ever since the early 20th century, leading Indian nationalists have tried to reinterpret these events as the first war for Indian independence, while some leftist historians call it the People's Uprising. As we'll see in this lecture, none of these names fully describes what actually happened during that brutal period or explains why. As you'll recall from previous lectures, it was an unusual colonial army that had conquered the 1.5 million square miles of India and its 270 million inhabitants over the century leading up to 1857. One distinctive feature is that the army was 85% Indian. That is, the army contained only about 40,000 Europeans and 250,000 Indian soldiers. These Indian soldiers were generally called sepoys, a name the British borrowed from earlier Indian martial traditions. In this colonial army, the term had come to mean Indians who served under British officers, who uniformly armed, dressed, and trained these Indians in semi-European ways. Another distinctive feature of this army was that it was officially part of the English East India Company, a joint stock corporation whose official goal was making profits to pay dividends to its shareholders. But from the mid-18th century, this company had begun to seize and rule vast territories in India. Seeing the situation as dangerous an anomaly, the British Parliament had set up a supervisory board of control in 1784 to supervise and direct this company's politics and administration. So by 1857, the English East India Company functioned both as a private corporation and also under the British government. This unsatisfactory situation would end following the 1857 fighting. Also, there were actually three distinct East India Company armies. The biggest one was based in Bengal, but there were two smaller armies based respectively in Madras and Bombay. They had separate regiments and rules and served under separate officer corps. But the Indians in the Madras and Bombay armies remained largely uninvolved in the 1857 fighting, so we'll concentrate on the company's Bengal army that was central to it. In the Bengal army, many of the Hindu sepoys were from high caste Brahmin families who held small and middle-sized farms on the North Indian Gangetic Plain. Others were Rajputs, a jati of traditional warriors and kings. There were also some regiments of Muslims, often the light cavalry. Many of these men followed their families' long traditions of military service as either full or part-time soldiers, hired by regional Indian rulers. Increasingly, over the previous century, they came to serve the British, since most Indian rulers were being defeated and deposed, with their territories annexed by the company. All these Indian men were volunteers, since there was no conscription or draft needed to recruit them. In fact, this military service in the East India Company's armies had been considered by many Indians to be an attractive profession with relatively good salary and social prestige. There was no real sense of being an Indian nation, so service to the British was not considered traitorous. However, all this was beginning to change in the decades leading up to 1857. this colonial army had become ever more clearly divided along racial lines. These three East India Company armies had relatively small proportions of white European troops, only about 15% of the total. But white and Indian soldiers served separately, never mixing, except in the heat of battle. The artillery, in particular, was considered too technical and powerful in battle to trust to Indians. So it was the preserve of European soldiers, although Indian servants did much of the hard work. There were also a few regiments of British soldiers, part of Queen Victoria's Royal Army, which rotated through India. But these white troops were far more expensive and remained much smaller in number than the East India Company's Indian soldiers. Even in sepoy regiments, Indians could not be promoted higher than petty officer, a non-commissioned rank, never in command over white soldiers. Indeed, the youngest, lowest-ranked British subaltern officer, like an ensign or lieutenant, outranked the most senior and experienced Indian officer. The company also tried to exclude men of mixed Indian and European heritage from the Army's officer corps. There were elaborate debates among the directors in London over how to classify candidates by race. Should it be based on the father, or the mother, or both, or on education, religion, native language, or deportment? But in practice, anyone without a proven white ancestry was officially excluded from the ranks of commissioned officers. Moreover, especially in the decade leading up to 1857, the financial allowances that had been previously allowed to sepoys were being reduced. No soldier likes to have his pay cut, especially when it seemed arbitrary. Sepoys also saw that many of the British officers treated them less respectfully. This reflected a growing British sense of cultural and racial superiority. Many sepoys resented this situation, especially when their British commanding officers used their rank to force Indians to obey orders they found disgraceful. For example, some British officers preached Christianity to their soldiers, who could not avoid these sermons without disobeying orders. In some regiments, Indian soldiers were forbidden to display marks of their own religion while in uniform. They were all forced to agree to serve overseas in strange and unhealthy lands, despite the high Hindu religious sanctions against leaving India and crossing the Kalapani, or Black Waters. What's more, some of their family farms were in kingdoms being annexed by the British, which deposed their king, reduced these families' long-held rights, and raised the taxes they had to pay on them as well. Promotion for both British and Indians was solely on the basis of seniority, so the ambitious felt frustrated when they could not get ahead. The quality of leadership also seems to have suffered. So Indian sepoys were increasingly feeling disrespected, underpaid, and deprived of their earlier privileges. These were some of the main contributing causes for their participation in the bloody conflict of 1857. But Indian sepoys were not the only ones who rose up against the British in 1857. Over the previous century, hundreds of Indian kings, both large and small, had been defeated and exiled by the East India Company's armies. The company then annexed their territories on one justification or another. Even loyal dynasties were taken over during the 1840s and 1850s under the so-called Doctrine of Lapse. This meant that the East India Company claimed to inherit the kingdom of any ruler who died without a legitimate male heir whom the company approved. The British exiled these former rulers, keeping them under the close watch of British custodians so they could not cause trouble for the new British administrators there. But that did not really prevent them from causing the British trouble. But British ideas about the social stature of hereditary aristocrats meant that many received large pensions. This was tax money taken from Indian farmers and merchants by the British and given to these deposed rulers to maintain a semblance of their former royal lifestyle. In order to lobby the British Parliament and Queen Victoria directly, a few of these former rulers went to London or sent their relatives or diplomatic representatives there. They wanted larger pensions and recognition from the British government that those pensions would be continually paid to their sons and grandsons. They also complained about abuses against them by British officials in India. One delegation even went to observe the Crimean War of 1853-56, where British armies and their Turkish allies were not doing very well against Russian imperial forces. Think of the heroic but disastrous British cavalry charge of the Light Brigade, and of the horrific condition of the British wounded that Florence Nightingale publicized and tried to alleviate. Thus, many of these deposed Indian rulers resented all that the British had done against them, saw that the British were not invincible, and therefore fought against the British in 1857. Some of the annexed kingdoms became centers for anti-British sentiment and fighting in 1857. Let's look at just two examples, Jhansi and Aud. In 1853, the Hindu king of the small central Indian state of Jhansi died, with his many wives, but only one adopted son. When the company annexed this kingdom for its own administrative convenience under the doctrine of lapse, the youngest widow, Rani Lakshmibai, objected. She wrote petition after petition to the company protesting that for generations her husband and his ancestors had been loyal to the British, sending money and troops whenever asked to do so. There was also a long-standing legal treaty in place that guaranteed the dynasty would be supported by the British and kept on the throne. But the company simply derecognized the adoption, pensioned off the Rani, and took over Jhansi. Rani Lakshmibai of Jhansi became one of the most celebrated heroines of the 1857 fighting, leading her followers into battle. She died of wounds suffered fighting nobly against the British. And she is remembered even today by Indian nationalists as a female martyr for the struggle for Indian independence. In 1856, one of the biggest remaining Indian kingdoms, Aud, was annexed by the company on the grounds of misgovernment. For nearly a century, this Shiite Muslim dynasty had been obediently subordinate to the British. It loaned the East India Company vast amounts of money, much of which had never been repaid. While the Aud king was deposed and pensioned in Calcutta, his mother, one of his wives, and his brother went to England to plead his case before the Parliament and Queen Victoria, but to no avail. Further, as soon as the company took over Aud, it began to take away some of the rights of landholders there. Many of the sepoys in the Bengal army came from that kingdom, and they feared for their family landholdings. They also lost some special privileges they had long enjoyed while Aud was an independent kingdom. As the fighting broke out in 1857, another wife of the ex-king and another of his sons became rousing symbols for the forces fighting against the British. Thus, for a series of reasons, Jhansi, Aud, and several other former North Indian princely states became the sites of some of the most bitter fighting during 1857. In addition, there were many other groups in Indian society that increasingly had grievances against British policies and rule. No one likes to be conquered and ruled by foreigners, especially when those foreign rulers increasingly intervene into your society, culture, and economy. So when the fighting broke out against the British in 1857, many diverse Indian people joined in. Some organized around their caste leaders, some around their religious leaders, and some around the deposed rulers, and also some around charismatic fighters. Now, most wars start with a sparking incident, but take force from long-standing grievances like those described above. On May 10, 1857, in the garrison town of Meerut, the Indians of the Bengal Army's 3rd Light Cavalry finally rose up against their British officers and their wives and children. These Indian soldiers had many specific provocations. The previous month, 85 of them had been arrested for disobeying the direct order to use a new type of rifle, the 577 caliber Enfield P-53. This muzzle-loading British-manufactured rifle had more firepower than earlier models, in some measure because the bullets fit more tightly down the rifled barrel and so were shot out with more power. But this tight fit meant that lubrication was needed to force the bullet down with a ramrod. In addition, this new model rifle came with pre-manufactured cartridges in which an exactly measured amount of gunpowder, along with the bullet, was covered by a greased paper. By biting off the top of this cartridge, pouring the gunpowder down the barrel, and then using the rest of the cartridge paper as a pre-greased wad, the soldier could fire much more fast and effectively, even in the heat of battle. This Enfield rifle proved its worth on many battlefields, including in the American Civil War. But Indian soldiers quite reasonably wanted to know what the source of the grease on the paper that they were putting in their mouths was. Many sepoys were sure it was made of cow fat or pig fat or a combination. Putting cow fat in your mouth polluted many Hindus, especially the high caste Brahmins and Rajputs who comprised much of the Bengal army. Pig fat offended many Muslim sepoys. The British officers claimed it was vegetable oil, but in truth really didn't know what kind of tallow the factory had actually used since the work had been contracted out to the lowest bidder. Ever since these cartridges had been issued to sepoy regiments at several military bases from the start of 1857 onward, there had been much discontent. Some regiments received punishment or were even disbanded for not obeying British orders to use them. One Brahmin sepoy, Mangal Pandey, became famous among Indians and infamous among Britons for his violent resistance to his British officers at the Barakpur base near Calcutta. He was executed on April 8th. So on April 24th in Meerut, when soldiers of the 3rd Light Cavalry Regiment refused to bite on the greased cartridges as ordered, dozens of them were imprisoned, court-martialed for mutiny, and sentenced to 10 years of hard labor and imprisonment. Faced with this prospect, many other Indian soldiers were ready to rise up. In addition, many of the Indian townspeople of Meerut ridiculed the sepoys stationed there for becoming outcasts by serving the British, especially for using these polluting new cartridges. They also called the sepoys cowards for not liberating their imprisoned comrades. This further aroused the Indian soldiers. Finally, early on May 10th, the soldiers in Meerut attacked the military prison, released their comrades, killed about 50 of their British officers and their families, and rushed the 36 miles to Delhi, which they quickly captured. They killed or drove away all the British men, women, and children they encountered. These Indian soldiers pushed their way into the Red Fort, where the 82-year-old Mughal Emperor, Bahadur Shah II, was a palace prisoner. Although he was reluctant to get involved, they proclaimed him the restored ruler over all of India. News spread rapidly, sparking uprisings across much of the Ganges Plain. Britons, including officers, officials, and merchants, as well as their families, fled. Hundreds were hunted down and executed or imprisoned. Institutions and symbols of the East India Company's government, including prisons, treasuries, post offices, telegraph stations, record rooms, and officers' quarters, were looted or destroyed. Many deposed or disgruntled Indian rulers and landlords joined in the fighting to drive the British out, although some hedged their bets by hiding and protecting refugee Britons in case the British recovered and reconquered. For the most part, the general populations of the central Deccan and South India stayed out of the 1857 fighting. So did the sepoys of the Bombay and Madras armies. But parts of these armies had earlier risen up at various times. As an example, over 50 years earlier in 1806, sections of the Madras army stationed at Vellore had killed 14 British officers and about 100 white soldiers. But this uprising did not spread, so British officers and soldiers were able to crush it, killing between 650 and 800 Madras sepoys and making sure the others did not rise up again. As soon as news of the Meerut uprising and the capture of Delhi reached British officials, they began to mobilize forces to restore British rule across North India. In Bengal, the government intercepted British army regiments on their way to China and marched them up the Ganges. Quite quickly, these British forces began to retake regions and cities they had lost. Banaras and Allahabad were retaken in a month. In the Punjab, the British had some white Royal Army regiments. Those few Bengal Army sepoy regiments stationed in the Punjab that showed signs of discontent were disarmed. The British also began to heavily recruit Punjabi Sikh soldiers. They largely regarded the sepoys of the Bengal Army as intruders who had conquered the Punjab in 1849. These forces soon besieged Delhi, recapturing it by September 1857. British officials in Nepal convinced the Gurkha ruler there to send his army to help restore British rule over North India. British forces recaptured Awadh's capital of Lucknow in March 1858, but the northern part of the Deccan remained the last major battleground, with Jhansi and Gwalior falling to the revengeful British in June 1858. Still, some of the scattered Indian rulers and their many sepoy followers remained in resistance for another year at least. So traumatic were these events that many people involved responded brutally. Indian sepoys, peasants, landholders, and bandits killed many British men, women, and children. As the British forces fought back, they were even more brutal, executing tens of thousands of Indians who looked like they might have been sepoys, or even just sympathizers. In fact, the British Army often used a particularly gruesome form of execution, tying the sentenced man to the front of a cannon, loaded only with gunpowder and not a cannonball, and then firing it off. This scattered the executed man's body over a wide distance. His fellow Indian prisoners were forced to watch and sometimes got splattered by his blood and flesh before they too were executed. Much of the strong racial animosity that characterized the later British Raj arose from the killings by both sides of people on the basis of their race. Until 1857, most British men and women felt safe even if they traveled alone through the Indian countryside. But after 1857, there arose among the British the powerful idea that Indians were bloodthirsty killers and threats to the sexual purity of white women. Many post-1857 British novels, poems, and plays, and other works of popular literature featured this inflammatory theme. The British also began to emphasize the so-called racial and communal differences among Indians. Not only did the British separate Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs in legal terms, they also tried to keep them apart politically. This was the British strategy of divide and rule. Some Muslim rulers used this British strategy for the protection and advantage of their own minority community. Since Muslims were the minority in most provinces, these Muslim leaders persuaded the British to create separate quotas for them in education and government service. When voting finally began to be available to elite Indians early in the 20th century, the British divide and rule strategy meant that they created separate electorates in which only Muslims could vote and only a Muslim candidate could win. After 1857, the British also made major changes in their military and political policies. The East India Company's armies were substantially reorganized. Many long-standing sepoy regiments were demobilized and the rest transferred into the new British Indian Army under the direct command of the British monarch, but still separate from the Royal British Army. Further, the new British Indian Army used the martial race theory to punish communities whose sepoys had risen up against the British and also to reward those communities that had supported them. In particular, high-caste sepoys from Bengal and the central Gangetic Plain were degraded by the British as an allegedly effeminate race, unworthy of being soldiers. These had been the heart of the East India Company's Bengal Army that had conquered much of North India, but now they were largely excluded from joining the new British Indian Army. In contrast, Nepali Gurkhas, Punjabi Sikhs, and also Muslims from the Northwest Province were received and designated as martial races. These regions and communities had supported the British in 1857. Several new Gurkha regiments were created in the British Indian Army. Indeed, Gurkha mercenaries still serve in the British Royal Army even today. Likewise, before 1857, Sikhs were largely excluded from the East India Company's armies, but they were massively recruited thereafter. By the start of the 20th century, Sikhs made up 20% of the Indians in the British Indian Army, although they were only 1% of India's total population. Even today, Sikhs are disproportionately represented in the Indian Army. In November 1858, Queen Victoria's government in Parliament took all political power in India away from the East India Company and eventually closed it down entirely, paying off its stockholders. The British Crown became the ruler of India. There had been growing dissatisfaction in Britain with the awkward status of the company, legally a private joint stock corporation seeking profits, yet largely controlled by the British government. Indeed, the company had also nominally been a subordinate official of the Mughal emperor ever since he appointed Diwan of Bengal in 1765, over 90 years earlier. But this legal shift from the company to British government did not change all that much on the ground in India. The Governor General now also received the title of Queen's Viceroy. The British and Indian employees of the company now worked for the Royal Government of India, or the British Raj, as it's popularly known. In terms of political policies, however, the new British Raj ended the company's annexation of Indian territories and the deposing of Indian rulers. Since much of the anti-British fighting had been led by deposed princes, many Britons came to believe that Indians did not deserve the benefits of allegedly enlightened British rule. Instead, they felt that Indians preferred their so-called natural leaders, who were feudal Indian princes. So the British Parliament had Queen Victoria issue a proclamation promising the more than 600 surviving Indian rulers that, unless they had directly fought against the British, they were guaranteed to keep their dynasties on the thrones and to maintain possession of their territories. These Indian princely states remained legally independent, with the largest of them having British-recognized sovereigns until 1947. About a third of the Indian subcontinent's total territory and a quarter of its people remained officially under the rule of these princely states. The largest of these princely states, Hyderabad, was about the size of France. Some were only a collection of villages. The British colonial government in India sent white British political agents to supervise and advise these princes. However, as one of the frustrated princes blurted out, "What's the point of calling it advice if we have to obey it?" Any prince who became too independent-minded was deposed, with a more compliant brother or son put in his place. This was the British system of indirect rule, which they developed in India and then copied in many other colonies in Asia and Africa. This system was relatively efficient for the British since a single British resident political agent could direct the prince's rule over the whole state. Then the prince and his administration had to implement these British dictated policies, no matter how unpopular they were. Plus, the subjects of the prince often blamed him rather than the British behind the throne for all of their grievances. Should any Indian nationalists enter the princely state or rise up there, they faced the prince's usually harsher judges, not British ones. Finally, especially when Indian princes ruled badly, this only made British colonial rulers look good in comparison. This was the beginning of the period of the British Raj, which we'll explore in more depth in the next several lectures.